Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss a new study by Shoemaker et al. Titled ETB Receptor-Mediated Vasodilation is Regulated by Estradiol in Young Women. This article was published September 3, 2021. Joining us today are Associate Editor Jason Carter, Senior Author Megan Wenner, and expert Lacey Alexander. Let's get started.
Thanks, Kara. Over the past couple decades, there's been increased awareness and attention to vascular health research in women. While long overdue, it is encouraging to see a shift in the field and a prioritization on women's health by organizations such as the National Institutes of Health. In the present study, Shoemaker and colleagues employed an endogenous hormone suppression with estradiol add-back to examine endothelium B receptor-mediated vasodilation in young, healthy women. This is a clinically relevant area given this receptor's mediated vasodilation is lost after menopause. Megan, congratulations on a great study, and I really appreciate the rigorous experimental approach you took in looking at endothelium B receptor-mediated vasodilation. Could you briefly recap the experimental approach and your primary findings?
Thanks, Jason. I'd like to start off just by thanking all of my co-authors on this study. It was a very collaborative project, so I really appreciate everyone's effort and hard work to complete the study. Our lab has been studying the role of the endothelin system and how this is a key mechanism for contributing to the declines in endothelial function in women as they age and experience menopause. As you mentioned in our prior work, we noted that the endothelin B receptor, or ETB receptor, mediated vasodilation in young women, but that this effect was lost after menopause. We were then interested to understand if this was due to aging or if this was due to the declines in estradiol that occur with menopause. So for this study, the goal was really to isolate and look at the specific effects of estradiol on the regulation of this ETB receptor. And we did this specifically in young women to remove any effect of aging on the vascular system. For our methods, we utilized a gonadotropin-releasing hormone antagonist to prevent any endogenous production of sex hormones, and then added back estradiol using a transdermal patch. This is an experimental design I learned from my former postdoc mentor, Dr. Nina Stackenfeld. In this manner, we're able to study the independent effects of estradiol, so without any changes in other hormones like progesterone. We then measured microvascular endothelial function in the cutaneous circulation using laser Doppler flowmetry while perfusing an antagonist for the ETB receptor through an intradermal microdialysis fiber. This is a technique pioneered by Dr. Alexander on the call as well. Our data show that when estradiol is present, the ETB receptor mediates vasodilation, but that when estradiol is absent or suppressed, this ETB-mediated dilation is lost. These effects mirror the differences we observed previously in our other study when we compared young and postmenopausal women. So our overall findings indicate that changes in estradiol regulate the function of this ETB receptor.
Thanks for that overview, Megan. I have one more question for you before we bring in Lacey to the conversation. I know you've previously studied this mechanism during key menstrual phases, including the early follicular and mid-luteal phases. That prior work demonstrated that endothelium B receptor blockade decreased cutaneous vasodilation during the mid-luteal phase when both estradiol and progesterone are high, but did not impact cutaneous vasodilation during the early follicular phase. In the present study, you conducted a GRAN add-back with estradiol, which begged to me the question if you've given any thought to a GRAN add-back with progesterone, especially given some of the evidence of progesterone's potential sympathoexcitatory roles. In other words, what potential role do you think progesterone plays in these complex vascular responses in women?
That's a great question, Jason. For this initial study, we did only focus on estradiol, but it sounds like a great follow-up study. Progesterone doesn't always get the attention it deserves when we think about women's health, because typically it's all about the estrogen, but progesterone can enhance vasoconstriction. It can negate the vasodilatory effects of estrogen on measures of endothelial function. And it's also important to consider the ratio of these two hormones. So the ratio of estradiol to progesterone, because as you know, Jason, from your work on the sympathetic nervous system, that ratio can be more closely related to changes specifically in what you saw in the sympathetic nervous system compared to just estradiol alone. I also think now that progesterone-only IUDs are becoming so popular, we need more studies to understand how this form of hormonal contraceptive is or is not impacting cardiovascular physiology. So there's definitely a role for it, and there's definitely a need for more attention in this area.
Lacey, you have done a lot of work in the cutaneous vascular regulation and health arena. Could you tell us your impressions of this study as it relates to the bigger picture of aging and health in women, and particularly what might have stood out to you as something valuable and impactful about the current work?
Thank you, Jason. First off, I'd like to congratulate Megan and her colleagues and her postdoc for such a nice study and a great progressive work forward in this arena. Like Megan had mentioned, I've used the cutaneous circulation for a long time to look at vascular health and different mechanisms mediating function and dysfunction with different clinical populations. I think this is a really interesting study because it partitions out the impact of aging versus the impact of estrogen on endothelin B receptor mediated function. Initially, and I think I can say this, I have had the pleasure of working with Megan and been reviewing her work throughout the years. And this is something that came up early on with her first study looking at menopausal women. And she's really pushed forward this arena, looking and partitioning out what's happening with age and estrogen in endothelin B receptor function and what's the role of endothelin A receptors. For this particular study, I think that from a bigger picture, you know, as women, there's really been a lack of work specifically relating to women and how estrogen and progesterone modulate vascular function and how that changes throughout the menopausal transition. As we know, vascular health declines sharply after menopause, and it's really important to know the larger role of how this happens and what is in particular regulating this, especially for developing intervention strategies early on so that we can help women maintain their vascular health for as long as possible. The other thing that I think is really interesting about this is that we know various reproductive diseases, including polycystic ovarian syndrome, like Megan has studied previously, and endometriosis, and as Megan previously talked about with progesterone-only IUDs, what is the impact of these various pathological states, as well as the impact of hormonal contraception on vascular health and some of the long-term implications of that? So those are the things that stood out to me, and it's been a real honor to watch this evolution and really Megan building up a very, very nice body of work in this area.
Thanks, Lacey.
I have one final question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Megan, and then get Lacey's thoughts on this. As scientists that study human neural and cardiovascular function, it's very easy to get caught in the exciting details of mechanisms of action, and we just dig deeper and deeper. But in the end, all of this research has to be couched within clinical relevance. As you both reflect on this study's piece of that puzzle for enhancing women's health, can you contextualize to our audience what excites you about the impact of this research or line of research, and where do we focus attention next to maximize our impact for women's health?
Thanks, Jason. Understanding more about these various pathways and these mechanisms that impact vascular physiology as well as other physiological systems and how changes in sex hormones are involved in regulating those processes are very important when we think about clinical use and the clinical translation. And in terms of hormone use, either with hormonal contraceptives or for hormone treatment, when we think of menopausal symptoms, I think this becomes very, very important for women's health. And in terms of menopause, we've seen a shift in the thinking around hormone therapy over the last 20 years. In the early 2000s, when the Women's Health Initiative was released, hormone therapy was viewed very negatively. But through additional studies, we now know that menopause hormone therapy can be utilized safely in things like formulations, whether it's transdermal or oral, as well as time of initiation are important when we think of safety and using these hormones safely. And that was based off of years of additional study and performing mechanistic studies. Our current study was conducted in young women. So right now we're looking to see if we can replicate these findings in postmenopausal women, or is there a point when vascular dysfunction becomes irreversible? But menopause is not the only thing that women are facing. As Lacey mentioned, there's PCOS, endometriosis, premature ovarian failure, all which involve a dysregulation of sex hormones and has impacts outside of just reproductive health or gynecology. So I think in terms of the bigger picture for women's health, performing studies that do focus on women only are important, as well as still aiming to focus on understanding sex differences and understanding biological differences between men and women. Lastly, I hope our study also just reinforces the need to consider sex hormones as an important variable or factor when we're thinking about experimental design, because we did observe an increase in microvascular endothelial function with estradiol exposure. So as everyone continues to work in this area, not only studying both men and women, but also focusing on women's health to make sure that we're considering not just sex, but also changes in sex hormones.
Thanks, Megan. That's a great segue into reminding our audience that we, AJP Heart and Circ, has an open call right now for manuscripts in the area of considering sex as a biological variable in cardiovascular research. So we hope people will consider that call. Lacey, any thoughts to add?
Yeah, Megan, I love your synopsis of the importance of studying sex hormones in addition to just basically biological differences between men and women, not just due to sex hormones. One concluding thought is that I think we're all aware that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women, and that we really need to, you know, think about what are some of the mechanistic underpinnings to that, but also at what point can we intervene? And I really like the point that Megan made about where, in terms of vascular health, where are the changes that we see points for intervention, and where are they points where it may be this damage to the endothelium and to the vasculature is irreversible. And importantly, I think that studying these mechanisms in humans is very relevant. So, you know, animal work, of course, has its place in the translational spectrum. But one of the things that I really like about this work in particular is that this is looking at some very basic mechanisms in human subjects. And considering that we can see different points in the regulation and how estrogen modulates this receptor function with endothelin B, I think that it's very interesting that it is relevant in young, otherwise healthy individuals and healthy women, and that how that might change as we progress forward down into the disease spectrum. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that, you know, we see that 1 in 10 women have endometriosis. We also see that the prevalence of things like PCOS is even higher than that. And, you know, we really have a lack of research into these specific diseases and how they impact long-term cardiovascular health. So I think Megan's work really provides a nice basis for proceeding forward with looking at, you know, different interventions and points of regulation to help women with these various gynecological disorders, but that ultimately impact their long-term cardiovascular health.
Those are really fantastic points, Lacey and Megan. Are there any other aspects of the study that either of you would like to highlight that we haven't discussed yet today?
One last thing that I'd like to say is I think that this model utilizing the GnRH antagonists or agonists in the ADBAC design that Megan learned from Nina Stackenfeld, who basically took this out of the reproductive endocrinology side of research and has employed it in the cardiovascular side. I think the model is very, very interesting in being able to isolate the different effects of hormones and their how they regulate vascular and cardiovascular function. So it's an expensive model to employ in research, but it also gives us a lot of very, very meaningful information. And I really applaud the subjects, the women, for injecting themselves daily for us to learn about these mechanisms and overall vascular health.
Great, great work. I would echo, you know, what Lacey said. I love the model. That's an intense protocol, though. And you're right,
intense.
Lacey, to have the women agree to do that. Cool model, though. Very cool.
And as part of our current R01, we're now doing this in perimenopausal women. So I always tell everyone, like, I'm going to be your best friend for 10 days because I text you, you know, to make sure everything, you don't have any side effects and the risks are low, but just to ensure safety that we're in close communication with them. So,
yeah. Wow.
Megan,
cool stuff.
Are you using Oralissa now, the oral formulation?
No, we've thought about switching, and I've had some discussions about trying to do this and started to look at, like, well, you know, what's the best like dose and how many days and things like that. But in order to kind of keep it consistent with this study, we've just, you know, kept it with the Ganirelix. The Ganirelix is expensive though. And I think it probably, from a subject comfort standpoint, it's obviously much easier to convince someone to just take a pill every day as opposed to injecting yourself with a syringe. So I think moving forward, as I'm starting to think of some other areas to get into, I do want to explore that more.
So we're looking at using Oralissa, but it would be really great to have a study looking at reproducibility and rigor between the Ganirelix and the Oralissa from a vascular side. So we should talk.
Yeah, definitely. Oh yeah, for sure.
Well, I want to, again, thank you, Megan, and thank you, Lacey, for being part of this podcast. Congratulations again, Megan, to you and your team. And I'll turn it back to you, Kara.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.